This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
We have serious issues to face, all of us do, as Americans, as citizens of the world, in coming to terms with what happened just 6 months ago today. And it's timely and appropriate that the discussion we're having this evening, in a sense, falls in this period of remembrance where we're looking back and thinking about exactly what it was that occurred on September 11th and the impact on our lives, how we think about our country, how we think about the world. And what I'd like to do tonight is explore with you some of the implications of September 11th for our democracy here in America and for the future of democracy around the globe. In doing so, I want to sketch a short history of how we Americans, and I know there are many in this audience who probably are themselves not Americans, you're perhaps visitors, you're students from abroad, but you're in America now, and you know that America has become the hyperpower, the hegemonic power in whose hands the fate of the globe, for better or worse, to a large extent, now lays. So in a sense, the prospects for this country become, willy-nilly, the prospects for the world, which is why so many people around the world tonight are anxious, nervous, watching what our government does, watching what our people do in response to the events as they transpire around the world. It wasn't always so, and we need to remember that for roughly the first 200 years of our history, we lived in a land that perpetrated on itself a kind of great and comforting myth. It was the myth of independence. We began our history with a Declaration of Independence, and the point of the Declaration of Independence was not simply to separate ourselves from England, but to say that we were a land in some ways outside of history and outside of time, that we were a land that, as Thomas Paine said, went back to the beginning of the world. We were the Puritans like to say, a second Eden, the shining city on the hill, a way for people who had suffered in Europe a tumultuous history of prejudice and bigotry and religious intolerance and war to start over again in a new land. We know how the mythology worked because the mythology had it as an empty land. And we know, in fact, the land was not empty. But the natives who lived here, the North American Indians, were kind of melded into the landscape, thought of, as Jefferson put it, as part of the flora and fauna of the New World. And of course, we brought with us, as we settled this country, slaves in slave ships. And this great new nation was founded, among other things, on a foundation not just of natural law and natural right and natural liberty, but also on slavery. And we had that to live with as part of our special history. But nonetheless, we Americans saw ourselves as separated from two great oceans, from the world, starting over again and conceiving a destiny that belonged to us alone. And for two centuries, we largely lived that myth. And what happened in this country, both the struggle for greater equality, the struggle to overcome slavery, the struggle for an extended franchise, that struggle happened independently of Europe. And throughout the 19th century, during Europe's wars, we Americans remained largely separate from them. And Europe's revolutions, we Americans remain separate from them. And even into the last century, the 20th century, as two great world wars enveloped the planet, we Americans viewed them from a distance. And we sent our young men over to fight, in some cases to die, and then come home again. But we were still spectators to that world war, fought on foreign soil. And so we came to believe, understandably, and perhaps even appropriately, that this was a special nation, exempt from the normal laws of history, exempt from the world's wars, the world's bigotries, the world's prejudices. Voltaire had talked about history as the history of prejudice and bigotry, but we didn't have a history. We were a land without a history, a country that made its own history. And so that myth of independence, and with it a certain myth of innocence, came. We were not just independent, but we were innocent of the world's histories. And despite the new crimes that we committed here in our own nation, as part of our history, we saw ourselves as exempt from the sins of the rest of the world, the innocent American. There's a wonderful story, Benito Cereno, by Melville, in which an American sea captain boards a Spanish slaver and is unable to understand what's happening on board. The slaves, in fact, have taken over the ship, and there's a cauldron of evil and torment going on, and the American captain, Delano, never quite gets it. He just can't understand it. We Americans have been like that, never quite able to grasp the horrors of foreign bigotry and prejudice, even though, were we to look, we had enough of our own here at home. And so we sustained through the last century and into the beginning of this new 21st century the myth that we could be a separate and independent country. And so on the evening news, not just the local news, but the national news, maybe there'd be 3 or 4 minutes of news about the world, and the rest was about America. And on the local news, no foreign news at all. And most Americans failed to learn languages, failed to understand the rest of the world. We, in fact, had the irony in the last 30 or 40 years of being one of the most multicultural societies on earth, in which, despite our own multiculturalism, we knew nothing about the world outside. A strange contradiction. And then came September 11th and the horrendous events. Some of you may have seen last night the extraordinary French film, in which a film crew was actually inside the World Trade Center and gave a kind of account from the inside of what it was like. Those events came, and the dream, the myth, was shattered for most of us. Those even who believed it most fervently were made suddenly to realize that America was part of a world, and that there were no oceans wide enough, no walls high enough to keep that world out. The terrorists came to us not just from above and from the outside, but from below and from the inside. Many had been here for years at a time, had experienced American culture, had experienced American exceptionalism, and still despised the culture that they had been part of, and were ready to try to destroy it. And it became apparent that 200 years of independence had now to come to an end, and that what was required, and this is what I want to talk about tonight, was a new declaration of interdependence. Not a prescriptive declaration, not one that said idealistically, we ought to be interdependent and part of the world, but one that said interdependence is an actuality, it is a fact, it is an ineluctable reality that we better come to terms with if we are going to survive. Not just as a democracy, but to survive at all. Now, the lesson of interdependence, of course, had been around for a much longer time than September 11th for most of the world, and even for those Americans who wanted to look. The two world wars of the last century were global wars, and America couldn't really look the other way and think it didn't matter whether the Germans, the Nazis, won or lost the war. And sooner or later, with or without Pearl Harbor, we would have been involved in that truly global struggle. And after World War II, again, for anyone with eyes, it was apparent that the national economies of the several states was increasingly being globalized, and that you could no longer deal with economics as a science of nationalities, but had rather to look at it in terms of a spreading globalization of commodities, of labor, of investment capital, which meant again that in the economic realm, interdependence was simply a reality. And it became apparent in the 60s and 70s and 80s that public health issues, issues of AIDS and viruses coming out of the hot zones of Africa, could no longer be contained by national borders. AIDS did not carry passports when it moved from nation to nation. And the new telecommunications technologies, as they evolved, increasingly rendered national borders porous. To which nation does the internet belong? In whose territory do we find cyberspace? Those questions are absurd, because we know that the new technologies, the new cyberspace, are genuinely interdependent and global in character. They are part of a network, and we cannot break that network into territorial units and try to define them that way. So, in fact, the reality of our interdependence has been around for a long time, but in this country it was up against the myth of independence, the myth of innocence, the myth of our separation, the notion that Americans could go it alone. We've always been lone rangers on the world scene, thinking we can do it alone. And when trouble comes, you strap on the six gun and get on your horse and ride out and take on the bad guys, and then ride home again. And of course, even in our government today, there are people who think maybe that's the way we ought to be dealing with the modern world. But on September 11th, we were presented with brutal and malevolent tutors in the arts and discipline of interdependence. Because terrorism is nothing if not an expression of the new interdependence. Our first instinct, of course, was to ask, where do they come from? Which country? Who do we make war on to defeat them? And the president asked the question immediately after September 11th, which states harbor the men and movements that have struck this blow to our World Trade Center and to our Pentagon? But of course, there was no easy answer to that. He said, we will not countenance states that harbor terrorists. But which states were those? And are there any states excluded? It turns out that among the states that harbor terrorists were New Jersey and Florida, not likely targets for an American military strike. And of course, the point about terrorism and about terrorists is that they are not typical and traditional agents of national sovereigns. In the old days, when you were attacked by a nation with an address. When Pearl Harbor was attacked, it was the Japanese Empire that had done it, and we could declare war on Japan. And since Japan was allied with Italy, fascist Italy, and Nazi Germany, we then declared war on them as well. It was an easy game, hard to execute, but easy to understand. There were states who were the principal actors. But terrorism is exactly like economics and technology and public health and ecology. It's not about states. It can't be identified with states. And there were no states to whom one could address the challenge to terrorism. Yes, there was Afghanistan, and we knew that the Taliban had been supporting parts of Al-Qaeda, and we knew that Osama bin Laden was there. But as has now become apparent, since the Taliban have been taken out and the Al-Qaeda cells there dismantled, it's become apparent that, in fact, it's done little to destroy terrorism, because terrorism is not Afghanistan, it is not the Taliban. Terrorism is a dimension, an aspect of malevolent interdependence, a perverse kind of interdependence. It's in the system. It's in the network. We live in a networked world, not a world of nation states. And both the maladies and pathologies of our time are in those networks, and the solutions and remedies to the maladies have to address the networks. One of the great international social scientists here on the West Coast is Manuel Castells. He's written a remarkable volume, three volumes, on the networked society. in which he makes it clear that it's no longer nation states, but networks, telecommunication networks, economic networks, information networks, social networks that constitute the reality of our times. But the problem of September 11th is that we are still lumbered, we are still encumbered with concepts and a political and social theory made in the 17th and 18th and 19th century. We've got smart bombs, but we've got stupid concepts to deal with the new world. We've got all this extraordinary new technology deployed on behalf of ideas born 200 or 300 years ago that are irrelevant to the new world. The danger is that the terrorists will have a better understanding of the interdependent network society and use it to their advantage than America or Germany or France that's trying to challenge and address terrorism, which still continues to think in these terms of the independent sovereign nation state, looking for another nation state to identify as the enemy and to strike out at. And that simply won't work. President Bush, it said, has on his desk in the Oval Office a piece of paper with 22 portraits of terrorists on it, the leading identifiable members of Al-Qaeda. And as they are captured or killed, he puts an X through them as a kind of visual reminder of the war he's engaged in. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that Al-Qaeda and terrorism is not a group of individuals any more than it is one state. It is a system. And putting X's through the faces of individuals doesn't begin to deal with a networked system of terrorism any more than Israel launching strikes into Palestine and rounding up and arresting the latest crop of potential bombers is going to deal with the situation there. The lines in front of Hamas go around the block. The problem Hamas has is how to triage and select from the thousands of young men and now young women who are lining up to be suicide bombers, those who it will choose for the missions. And the idea that you will strike at and end terrorism by exterminating or arresting or prosecuting individuals is again part of a misinformation, part of a misconceived view of how the new world works. In fact, we live in a world of ineluctable interdependence. And the place that is most clearly seen is in the economy. And the question I want to raise with you tonight is whether in this new world of interdependence, where terrorists roam freely and operate so easily, and where international corporations and multinational banks and firms also roam and operate easily beyond the control of the law, whether there is a chance for democracy to survive. Because the story I've told up until now, the story of the nation state, its independence, its sovereignty, its isolation, has also been, for better or worse, the story of democracy in the last 300 years. Democracy has been a creature of the nation state. Democratic institutions, for better or worse, and they're always not always so democratic, but they have developed in the context of the nation state and the growth of the nation state. And if we are approaching the end of the era of nation states, where new actors, new entities in a new interdependent network world will dominate, the question is, what is the future of democracy going to be? We've seen that terrorists operate easily in that new interdependent world. So do drug criminals. So do the people who trade in weapons. So do diseases. So do the plagues of global warming and other ecological plagues. We live in a globalized world that looks often like a world in which we have globalized almost all of our vices and almost none of our virtues. Look at what's been globalized: the weapons trade, crime, prostitution, terror, international exploitation, and in particular, the exploitation of women and children. If you want to see the real victims of globalization, look at the world's children, because at the end of every outlook internationally, you will find an oppressed, a marginalized, a dead child. Children are paying, in particular, the price of globalization. Look at the pictures of the proxy wars going on in Africa and the Middle East and elsewhere, and you will see pictures of 14 and 15-year-olds who, in many cases, are killing 14 and 15-year-olds. Kids hardly able to bear the weight of the bandoliers of ammunition and the AK-47s they hold in their hands, making war. Our proxy warriors. Children on the streets of Rio and Sao Paulo in Brazil who are homeless, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, roaming the streets, and then caught, murdered, and their organs cut out and farmed and sold in North America. 12-year-old boys and girls in Thailand who are made into prostitutes and put on the internet and made part of internet-sold sex tours. That's part of the global economy, an official a part of it, not an unofficial part of it. Again and again, it's children and their mothers who seem to pay the price. And every time the World Bank or the IMF goes into a nation and says, in order to get investments that you need, you are going to have to impose economic discipline on your economy, and that means you will have to cut back on social services and on social safety nets, the people who pay that price are first of all the children and their mothers. And of course, it's a vicious circle, because if the governments don't impose that discipline, the IMF will not make the investments, and without the investments, the economy doesn't have a chance. But on the other hand, if they impose those discipline to get the investments, the suffering that their own people go through mean that the investments can't do the job that they're supposed to do. Because above all, what we've done in the new interdependent globalization is to globalize the economy. We have globalized private markets. We have globalized markets in labor. We've globalized markets in commodity. We've globalized markets in financial capital. They go where they will, and there is no sovereign nation that can any longer control or regulate financial capital or jobs or industry or investments, because now they can move freely in this new world of free trade anywhere they please in the world, which means they will move to the place where profits are greatest, where the cost of investment are the least, and where there is the least resistance to investments. And that means places where there are no laws against child labor, no laws on safety standards, no laws that protect the environment, no laws on worker safety. Global capitalism has become a race to the bottom for global capital, and where it earns the most profit is where there is the least regulation. The less rule of law, the better it is for capitalists. So that globalized capitalism has, in effect, freed itself from the constraints of the democratic nation state. Now, I want to suggest that this asymmetrical globalization, because that's what it is, a globalization of the economy, in the absence of a globalization of the democratic and political and civic institutions that have historically surrounded the capitalist economy, has been devastating for democracy, devastating for the peoples of the world, but also devastating for capitalism. Because the history of capitalism has been a history of synergy between democracy and market institutions. Capitalist markets have proved themselves entrepreneurial, competitive, and productive, more so than any other economic system. They're extremely good at production. They're extremely bad at distribution. They're not very good at creating jobs, and they tend, left to their own devices, to be self-destructive. That's an old lesson. Marx was wrong about a lot of things, but he was right about the contradictions of capitalism, something on which capitalist economists have remarked again and again. Capitalism, for example, needs and wants competition, but tends to create monopolies. Doesn't know how to do anything else. It needs democratic laws and democratic states to keep the competitive framework of entrepreneurship alive. It needs to produce jobs, not just commodities, because job holders have incomes and they become the consumers that consume capitalism's commodities. But it tends to produce more commodities than jobs. And when it does that, that means people without jobs can't be consumers, so there are more and more commodities and less sales, higher and higher inventories, and that starts this cycle of unemployment and overstocked inventories that in Asia has led to a 10-year-long recession that goes on today and is at the root of our problems today in the United States. Now, those contradictions are contained and overcome within the context of a capitalist market regulated by law, regulated by democratic surveillance, regulated by democratic government, and also regulated by the local institutions of civil society that put a human face on capitalism and deal with some of its depredations and dangers, whether it's local philanthropic institutions or the local church or synagogue or mosque or families, which are able to deal with some of the consequences of capitalism. But what globalization has done is taken that capitalism that has sat comfortably and synergistically inside of the democratic nation state and ripped it out of that envelope and set it loose in an anarchic global framework where democratic institutions and civic institutions have not been globalized. It has set capitalism free and brought out its most brutal, its rawest, its wildest streak, and turned it into an engine of exploitation and oppression, whereas it had been an engine of productivity and prosperity. And that's bad not just for democracy and bad for the social welfare of people around the world, it's also bad for capitalism. It doesn't work well outside the box, but it is now outside the box, it's outside the envelope. That's what asymmetrical globalization has done. Stripped it of its democratic container and left it alone in an anarchic world. And in this, capitalist markets and terrorism share something. They share the benefits of anarchism because the global marketplace, the globally interdependent world, is a world without law, a world without political regulation, a world without economic regulation, a world that is genuinely an anarchic place. And while anarchy may serve the profitability of corporations, it also serves the profitability of terrorists. Terrorists and global firms both try to take advantage of the anarchy of international relations in a world without global democratic institutions, without the global rule of law. So the reality is that on September 11th, terrorism, as it were, caught up to the marketplace and began taking advantage of the same anarchy, the same internationalism, the same interdependence that had, for 20 or 30 years, been how capitalism had globalized itself. And the question we face today is whether we have a response to the anarchy of terrorism that will also be a response to the anarchy of the global marketplace. The question we face is, what is the relationship between terrorism and the global marketplace? Is it possible that the anarchy, the oppression, the exploitation which global capitalism represents when it's outside of the box of democracy is associated with the kinds of conditions that in time nurture terrorism? Terrorists themselves, the individuals who did the dastardly deeds in New York and Washington last fall, are not themselves impoverished and are motivated by many different things, several of which I think are pathological in the extreme. But the climate in which terrorism grows is a climate in which the divisions between North and South, between rich and poor, have become greater and greater as capitalism globalizes itself. The conditions in which terrorism grows are the conditions that speak to despair and hopelessness among the great majority of the world's people. President Bush spoke about an axis of evil. And that may or may not be an appropriate phrase, but we have to also recognize there is an axis of inequality and an axis of despair and an axis of rage in the world. Peoples who see globalization not as promising them a better life, but stealing from them the possibility of a better life for them or their children. A majority of the world's people experience globalization in both the globalization of capitalism, the globalization of our goods and our brands, what I've called McWorld, fast food, fast computers, fast music. They experience that as a threat to their native cultural and religious and ethical values. They see it as a threat to their way of life, not as an opportunity for a more liberated lifestyle, but as the destruction of everything they hold dear, and particularly targeted at their children, because once again, the world economy and the world's commodities are targeted at children. And if you think this is an odd story to be telling, just think about the 2 million American fundamentalist Christian families who now homeschool their own children because they are so frightened of the public culture that is out there in the world. And you might say, well, they're fanatics and they're crazy and what do they know? But the fact is they're Americans and they are religious and they're not Muslims, they're Protestants, fundamentalist Protestants. And they see in our public culture, in the multiplex and in the mall and on the internet and on television, a violent, secular, materialist culture that threatens their Christian beliefs. And if they feel that way growing up inside America, imagine how people in the third world, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, must feel when they see a secular culture of brands focused on the kind of thing that you see when you turn on your television set every night in the advertisements. Imagine how they feel about their cultures. And it's not just a matter here of them saying, we want to join globalization, we want to join global capitalism, we want to profit from it. With half their hearts, they say, let us be part of the new prosperity. And with the other half, they say, spare us from the prosperity that brings with it this devastating commercial, materialist, secular culture. And there's that ambivalence, and it's in many of us as well. It's certainly in me. I'm attracted to the pop culture of America, its movies, its fast food, its delights, and at the same time, I'm horrified. I'm terrified by it. And I feel that way for my own children, who I want to have all the benefits of that culture, and yet I worry it will destroy any sense of cultural and religious seriousness if they really share that culture. Those of us who teach or are students in this room ought to know that, in fact, the job we do as professors and teachers is a small part of what the young people in this room receive from the world. We are not really the teachers of the young anymore. As a college teacher, I have students maybe 3-4 hours a week. If I taught in high school or primary school, I would have kids maybe 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, 30 weeks a year. But for 52 weeks a year, 6 to 8 hours a day, our children are in the hands of a very different tutor, the tutor of the multiplex, the ubiquitous screens, the big ones that show Hollywood films, the smaller ones that show television, and the little ones that show the internet. those are the true teachers of Americans. Have a good look at what's on them, because that's what your children will learn. And that's why so many, even Americans here, are terrified by that culture, and imagine how people elsewhere in the world feel about its coming. When the pioneers first come, the pioneers of the cola companies and the fast food companies and the television stations that are the vanguard of a massive culture of McWorld, which is in its essence materialist, secular, often violent, meretricious, and homogenizing, destructive of the pluralism that is the essence of our democracy. It can, in the beginning, be experienced as liberating. If you live in a traditional culture, you may first experience the advent of CNN and McDonald's as kind of, well, that's nice, there's something different, there's an alternative. But in time, they come to permeate and pervade and control and take over, and then there is nothing but that culture. In Kyoto, to have 5 McDonald's is probably a nice thing. 50 is okay. 500 is a problem. 5,000, and there's nothing left of Japanese food. And the trouble is, capitalism's imperative is to grow and grow and grow and grow. It can't stop because it needs to ensure the profitability of its company and profits for its shareholders. So it wants it all, necessarily, and it will go on growing. When Coca-Cola went to India in the late 1980s, said it's time to introduce cola drinks here, it found there's already a national drink there. It was tea. Coca-Cola looked around and said, gee, an awful lot of people drink tea here, and that's nice, but if they drink tea, they won't drink Coca-Cola. What are we going to do about that? And they said in the 1991-1992 corporate report, what we have to do is make war on Indian tea culture. Because, of course, people don't just drink tea. Tea is associated with religious rituals, family rituals, certain way of socializing. And those all get in the way of the Coca-Cola market. So it's not cultural imperialism in the old sense of somebody wanting to take over. It's just that if you want people to drink Coke, you've got to get the tea culture out of the way. You want people to eat fast food all the time, then you've got to get slow food and family food and eating at home and Thanksgiving out of the way, because they stand in the way of fast food. And so McWorld becomes a pervasive and ineluctably and inadvertently, but still realistically, colonizing force that homogenizes and takes over and threatens local cultures, whether they're religious or ethnic or national or cultural in character. Now, I don't want to say that McDonald's causes terrorism. That would be absurd. But it's interesting that way before the terrorists of September 11th, in Greece, in France, in China, people would send rockets through McDonald's. People would drop bombs into McDonald's. They were perceived as the vanguard of an alien and threatening culture. And maybe the people doing it were crazy, and maybe they were violent terrorists, and they were pathological, but they saw a threat to themselves in it that made them want to blow them up. And we better understand what that's about. And why what appears to us as a natural process of globalizing the good old lifestyle of America appears to other people as a threat to their indigenous autonomy, to their cultures, and to their religion. Because that's at the core of what happened on September 11th. We need now to find a way to globalize our democratic and civic institutions. We will not put the globalized economy back into the nation-state bottle. It's out, and it's out for good. The anti-globalization movement is a misnomer. You cannot stop or arrest globalization. The only thing you can do is divert it and ask the question, who's globalization? Globalization of what? Globalization for whom? And the answer to that question has to be democratic globalization, a democratized globalization, or a globalized democracy to stand alongside of the globalized marketplace and the globalized pop culture, so that we have an alternative structure of public goods and public interests, and that we have a way through the rule of law and regulation to contain the depredations of the economy and to bring to justice the terrorists who operate. How ironic that the United States refuses to sign on to the new International Criminal Tribunal and support the international court, when it's precisely an international court that we need to take on the criminality of the terrorists. All the problems we had at Guantanamo Bay of defining who are these people and how do we try them under military or civilian law, those were all created by the contradiction of our wanting to try, according to traditional national law, new international criminals who have to be seen in the context of the new internationalism, and therefore have to be tried by international courts and international law. We also have to fight whatever wars we fight against terrorism in a coalition of partners. They have to be fought internationally, not nation by nation. Unilateralism isn't just offensive to our allies. It's ineffective as policy. It won't work. That's its problem. Interdependence means that multilateralism has become a necessity of effective foreign policy. We either do it with the other nations or we're not going to do it, because that has become, in general, the lesson of interdependence today. The new interdependence means that either the whole world solves its economic problems, becomes a more just place, or nobody prospers. America cannot prosper alone in a world that does not prosper. We learned with horror what it is like to lose 3,000 of our sons and daughter overnight in an indiscriminate and horrendous slaughter. But millions of families around the world have lost daughters and sons slowly, not overnight, but over weeks and months and years, through starvation and disease and poverty, because we have not deployed our own wealth and resources to the advantage of all, but only to our own advantage. And what the terrorist acts of September 11th said is, you will no longer do that. You will either share those resources or not have them at all. You will not live in contentment while others live in pain. You will share our pain. That is also the lesson of the terrorists, taught by irresponsible and malevolent men, to be sure, but lessons that need to be learned. The America that has been independent and in its own way innocent for so long can no longer do so. Internationalism is not idealism today, it's political realism. Global democracy is not the childish dream of wishful thinkers in the World Federalist Society. It is a necessity of national survival. It is the new political realism. We will have global justice institutions, or there will be no justice. We will have global regulation of the economy so that all benefit, or none will be allowed to benefit from the productivity of capitalism. That's not wishful thinking. That's not an aspiration. That is a reality of the new world order in which we live. We will no longer do it alone, make it alone. We will make it with others, or we will not make it at all. If we didn't know it before, we have to know now that we live in a single boat, as it were. And when there's a hole at the other end of the boat, we don't say, well, that's at your end of the boat. We have to plug that hole. We live in one house, and if we're in the second and third floor with the good views and the guy in the basement has an apartment that's on fire, we're all going to burn up. You can't say, well, that's in the basement, it's not our problem. Interdependence means each man's problem is every man's problem. Interdependence means one nation cannot do well unless all nations do well. Interdependence means that capitalism taken out of the national democratic envelope has to be put back into an international democratic envelope and be contained and regulated that way. Those are the new necessities. Whether our government yet recognizes it, I'm not sure. I'm not as pessimistic as some people. I think Colin Powell in the State Department, I think some people at Defense, I think sometimes even George Bush begins to understand that these are realities. But to be sure, on September 11th, two doors opened, not one. One door was a door that opened onto jingoism, nationalism, militarism, the Lone Ranger, let's do it alone, let's take care of ourselves, let's go out and shoot down the enemy and come back home and close the doors again, and we'll be okay. But the other was the one that said, we can't do it that way anymore. We've got to do it together. We've got to do it with partners. And in fact, 10 days after the September 11th bombings, we paid our UN dues abruptly. Interesting. Not out of goodwill, not out of altruism, but that's a good thing. Altruism is a bad motivator of politics. Self-interest is a good motivator. We did it because we understood we had to do it, because we were going to need the United Nations. And even at Guantanamo Bay, when we first said we're not going to abide by the Geneva Convention, our European allies said, all right, then we're not going to turn over our terrorist prisoners to you. And we said, you know what, maybe we will abide by the Geneva Convention. That is acknowledging the new political realism. That is acknowledging the reality of interdependence. And we need to do that more and more. And if our government doesn't do it, if our government is stupider than the terrorists that it wants to take on and challenge and prosecute, then we have to change that government and get a government that understands reality at least as well as the terrorists do. It's not a match if the terrorists understand the world better than we do. If they understand and utilize its interdependence, while we reject and pretend that interdependence is not a reality and we can do it alone, because we will surely fail to deal effectively with the terrorists under those circumstances. So these brutal lessons in the new political science that the terrorists taught us on September 11th, and that AIDS and the West Nile virus taught us last year, and the global warming taught us the year before that, and that we should have learned a long time ago, and that have already been learned by the Europeans after World War II, when they didn't go back to the nation states but began to develop a European transnational system. These are lessons we Americans now have to learn. And if we are going to be part of the world, then that means we better start learning its languages, because we can't afford intelligence services that don't speak the languages of our enemies and don't understand their communiques. And there is nobody today in the CIA who speaks Pashtun who can actually understand the language in which our enemies do their business. And we often turn over their communiques to officers in foreign intelligence services who are on the side of our enemies to have them translated for us. And you can imagine what, you know, one of them says to us. What did our enemies say? Oh, they say they're not their enemies. They say they like you very much. They bear you no ill will. Don't worry. No problem. But, you know, this goes way back. I mean, our universities and colleges no longer insist on foreign languages as a requirement, not just for BAs, but for MAs and PhDs. When I got my PhD, I had to learn two foreign languages well. Today, the students I teach are allowed to take statistics instead. You know, and that, you know, maybe allows you to count the bodies, but it doesn't allow you to do much more than that when it comes to understanding foreign cultures. And we live in a social science environment where positivism and comparative survey research has taken the place of cultural and area studies. Again, to our detriment, because we no longer have scholars who can understand how foreign cultures work, what they're about, what they mean, And we have to, if we're going to be part of that world, retrieve that world. The hope is, of course, that America is by far the most multicultural society on earth. This great state of California, I'm happy to say, last year became the first American state in which there was no longer any majority, not white, not black, not Latino, not Asian American. A state of minorities, and this whole country will soon be a nation of minorities. And that's to me, an ideal democracy, where there is no majority, but a series of minorities, all of whom have to learn to live with one another and learn each other's ways. And if we can learn each other's ways, we can certainly learn the world's ways. We are in some ways already a global society with global cities like Los Angeles, where 162 languages are spoken by the children in the public school system there, and New York and Miami. And if we can be within ourselves a global society, then we are perfectly positioned to understand and be part of and exercise leadership in a multicultural world. But to do that, we need to put finally to rest the idea that we are alone in the world and masters of our own destiny separate from that world. That means we have to join and be part of those international organizations, even when they don't always respect our interests. That means we have to be part of an international tribunal system, even though that means we have to sometimes sacrifice our sovereignty and allow others to try our citizens. That means we have to be part of international military coalitions, even when that means American troops sometimes go to battle under foreign commanders, something we don't now allow even within NATO. That means we have to acknowledge that we are part of a world and only part of its solutions, and our survival and our liberty depend on those partnerships. That is the reality of the new world, and we need political and civic leadership that understands that. And we need to support those elements in the current political leadership that know and understand that, because this discussion that we're having here is going on inside of the White House and inside of Washington today. There are some who say we need more coalition, we need more partnership, we need to join those organizations even when they seem to be adverse to our interests, and others who are saying, no, we can go it alone. We don't need the world. We can solve this problem by ourselves. Build more nukes, build small nukes, build big nukes. Nuclear weapons cannot solve these issues. Because, of course, nuclear weapons themselves are perfect examples of interdependence. You cannot drop a bomb somewhere else and know exactly where the fallout is going to go. You cannot drop a nuclear bomb on someone else without setting off an arms race in nuclear weapons, which will come to affect us. Nuclear weapons were, in fact, the beginning of the new world of interdependence. And to think that they are a way around interdependence is to totally misunderstand their character. So we do face, 6 months after September 11th, a crucial turning point in our own history. Which of those two doors will we go through? The door marked unilateralism, the Lone Ranger, we'll fix it ourselves, Fortress America, or the door labeled interdependence, do it with others, make globalization work, democratize globalization, globalize democracy, create a new envelope of civic and political and humane institutions around global capitalism so that capitalism becomes as productive for other nations and for the world as it has been for America. That is the question we face. And the good news is it is finally going to be our decision. You can't blame Bush. Don't laugh at Bush. Don't blame Bush. We voted for him, sort of. And every one of the leaders who we look to are our products. And if the democracy is not working well, that's not their fault, it's our fault. So that this is really not their decision, it is our decision. And it's a critical moment of testing for our democracy. Will we take our democracy seriously enough to elect a leadership capable of creating a globalized democracy, of acknowledging the interdependence in which we live so that we can create partnerships around the world that defeat terrorism. Not by X-ing out the faces of individual men, but not by breaking up the cells, but by making terrorism irrelevant in a world in which religious diversity, a world in which ethnic differentials, a world in which prosperity is shared right across the globe, a world in which our finest aspirations, which we have not yet lived up to here, become a reality for peoples all over the world. Let me end by reminding you of the relationship between terrorism and democracy. The essential definition of terrorism is powerlessness. Terrorists are men and women without power. They have no power, and they use violence to try to leverage those who have power. Take the terrorists on September 11th. Those 19 young men had no power. They had box cutters. That was it. But they took our power. They took our transportation, our airplanes, our credit system, and they turned it against us. They used our power because they had none. Democracy is ultimately about empowerment. It empowers all of us to be in control of our destiny. The only answer I know in the long term to terrorism and its logic of powerlessness is to empower people. Because people who are empowered, people who have control of their own destinies, who participate in the decisions that affect their communities, do not need violence, do not need terror to have an impact on the world. People who take hope from life don't fall in love with death and believe that only death can bring them satisfaction. So we do have a response, an answer to terrorism, but it's not nuclear weapons. It's not ongoing and endless military campaigns, although some may be necessary in the short run. The answer to terrorism long term is making democracy work for everyone. And to make it work for everyone means globalizing democracy. That, I know, is a hard and difficult task. And for a long time, it was thought as an impossible dream, a silly dream of romantic idealists. But it has now become a mandate of necessity for any free people who wish to survive in a world that will either be governed democratically by everyone or will be governed by terrorists and in the end destroyed. Thank you very much.